From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Memorial Day edition of Fresh Air, we remember the Great War, as it was called, World War I. About 10 million people died, about 20 million were wounded. We'll talk with Neil Ferguson about his new book, The Pity of War, explaining World War I. Also, a remembrance of those who died documenting war. We hear from photojournalists Horst Voss and Tim Page. They were both wounded while covering the war in Vietnam. They edited the 1997 book Requiem, a collection of photographs taken by their colleagues who didn't survive. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton used his Memorial Day speech at Arlington National Cemetery to try to convince Americans to support the NATO air campaign against Yugoslavia. The president noted that many Americans believe that this is not a U.S. fight, but he said that many of the servicemen and women buried in Arlington are there because the world waited too long to intervene in Europe during the Nazi era. NATO's air attacks stepped up, with pilots launching what the Allies say were the most airstrikes in a 24-hour period in the campaign. Serbian officials say the strikes caused more civilian losses. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from NATO headquarters in Brussels.
The list of locations NATO says it has struck grew sharply today, marking some of the heaviest bombing of the war. NATO reported hitting army barracks in six locations, five military storage sites, and an unusually high number of tanks, 12 in all. Serb authorities report strikes on bridges carrying civilians, a retirement home, and Western journalists in Kosovo. As NATO repeated its contention, it does not target civilians. One of the biggest opponents of the Allied bombing prepared for another diplomatic mission. Russian envoy Viktor Chernomyrdin rejoins Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot and the EU emissary, Finnish President Matti Ahtisaari, in Bonn for more talks tomorrow. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Brussels.
Firefighters are nearing total containment of a fire in California, which has destroyed portions of Joshua Tree National Park. Steve Futterman reports.
The good news is that officials have now contained more than 90% of the blaze. A series of four separate fires have burned more than 13,000 acres of the fragile desert habitat at Joshua Tree. Lightning strikes are blamed for setting off the fires. Two of them were quickly put out. Another burned nearly 2,000 acres. The major blaze, though, the one firefighters have had the most trouble controlling, has consumed more than 11,000 acres. Firefighters have had to struggle with rough desert terrain along with high winds, snakes, and even scorpions. Because of the fragile nature of the terrain, the firefighters are trying to keep their vehicles and other equipment on roads and trying to battle the fire as much as they can by hand. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
India has agreed to high-level talks with Pakistan over the current conflict in the disputed state of Kashmir. India continued its offensive against rebels who are dug into mountainous positions in the part of Kashmir controlled by India. India's foreign ministry said today that Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee has agreed to a visit from Pakistan's foreign minister. Vajpayee had earlier rejected an offer from UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to send an envoy to the region in an effort to reduce tensions. This is NPR News. Students and faculty at Columbine High School in Colorado are preparing to go back to school tomorrow for the first time since two student gunmen killed 13 people and then themselves. Tomorrow, the returning students will be allowed to pick up the backpacks, purses, and other items they were forced to leave behind when Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold opened fire on April 20th. Parents have been invited to accompany their children, and counselors will be available. Israel's militia allies are pulling out of a southern Lebanon town. The troops have occupied Jezzine for the past 14 years. James Schofield reports the area is very tense as the soldiers prepare to leave.
In this high, almost mountainous country dotted with pine trees, Israel's militia allies are always on the lookout for roadside bombs. Early on Monday, as they patrolled the main road to Jezzine, perhaps for a final time, a group of soldiers spotted one seconds before it blew up. Israel's Lebanese allies aren't always so lucky. And it's because of attacks like this that the SLA is pulling out. Most militiamen we talked to today were tense, jumpy, and united by suspicion of their own Lebanese government and by hatred of the Islamist resistance movement Hezbollah. Many will be leaving soon. No one knows exactly when, but their departure may be measured more in hours than in days. For NPR News, I'm James Schofield in Jezzine.
Officials in Colombia say rebels are still holding as many as 60 people captive after kidnapping an entire church congregation yesterday. The rebels, wearing Colombian army uniforms, told the congregation in a wealthy area of Cali that there was a bomb threat at the church, then herded everyone into trucks and took them away. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Memorial Day is set aside to remember those who have died in war. About 10 million people died in the First World War between the years 1914 and 1918. About 20 million were wounded. My guest Neil Ferguson has written a new book about World War I, how it changed the nature of war and changed the world. He teaches modern history at Oxford and is also the author of The House of Rothschild. Ferguson is British, and he says that the First World War was worse for his country than the Second. For example, more British soldiers were killed in World War I than World War II. I asked him for other examples.
Well, I think one could make a general statement, which would probably be true of all the European states, namely that the First World War was a bigger shock. When the Second World War came along, there was a very clear memory of what war was like. No one had any illusions about the enormous loss of life that would arise in the event of a major European war. Whereas in 1914, it's clear that only the real specialists, the military planners, the people who understood what heavy artillery could do, really grasped in 1914 what a European war meant. And I think for that reason, the trauma, the caesura is that much greater. The difference between pre-war and post-war is somehow greater in the case of the First World War than it is in the case of the Second World War, when everybody knows that they're letting themselves in for hell when war breaks out.
Before we get to some of your theories about the First World War, would you describe a little bit about what the Western Front was like, what the trench warfare of the day was like?
Well, trench warfare was a kind of return to siege warfare in one sense, namely from a very early stage, really from the early days of 1915, the positions on the Western Front were pretty much fixed. Very little territorial change occurred until the spring of 1918, and in the rest of 1918, the war became a war of movement again. So for most of the war, the front is very static, much more than on the Eastern Front, where there's much greater mobility. And that means that the common experience of combat on the Western Front was that you sat in a hole in the ground and you hoped that the shells wouldn't hit you. Most people, the majority of people, are killed by artillery shells. They're not killed in action by bayonets or rifles. And indeed, going over the top into action on an offensive is an exceptional experience. So it's a very sedentary war, and it's an extremely nerve-wracking war, because I think it's safe to say that the experience of being bombed, of being shelled for hours at a time in these massive artillery bombardments which went on the Western Front was probably one of the worst experiences a human being could have in the 20th century. Even if you survived it, your nerves were completely shattered.
But would you describe one of the battles that had massive casualties?
Well, from the British point of view, the most notorious battle is the Battle of the Somme, with Passchendaele as a close second. The Battle of the Somme happens in 1916. In the summer of 1916, a massive army has been accumulated and is sent towards German positions over the relatively flat battlefield of the Somme. Not a particularly good place to fight a battle, but chosen because it was close to the French, and the French seemed to need some support. And for reasons which are intimately bound up with the lack of British preparation for the war, the fact that there simply hadn't been a big British army in 1914, that almost everybody who goes over the top in 1916 has been very hurriedly trained, and because the army itself does not really have a theory of how you fight this kind of war, they march pretty slowly and steadily towards German machine gun emplacements, which have been more or less unscathed by the preceding bombardment. Now, the effect of the bombardment, which the British commander Haig firmly believed would shatter German resistance, was simply to warn the Germans what was going to happen next. The Germans had dug themselves in deep. When the shells stopped, up they came from their emplacements, took up their machine guns, and they simply mowed down the advancing British soldiers. And the casualties on the first day alone number tens and tens of thousands. The numbers killed in the whole of the Battle of the Somme, which lasted for several months, for Britain were greater than the number of Americans killed in the whole Vietnam War.
That's pretty amazing figures. The First World War resulted in a lot of terrific literature, much of it anti-war literature. You quote Ernst Jünger's diary of a German front line at Guillemont in August of 1916, and he writes, "Among the living lay the dead. As we dug ourselves in, we found them in layers, stacked up one on top of another. One company after another had been shoved into the drum fire and steadily annihilated." You also have a lot of pretty gruesome photographs in the book from World War I. But the photograph I actually found most shocking was a photograph of Scottish troops wearing kilts. And I'm thinking, wow, this is like fighting trench warfare in a skirt. It astounded me.
It astounded the Germans, too. One of the things that German writers about the war, men like Jünger, often commented upon was the particular aggressiveness and ferocity of the Scottish regiments, who were instantly recognizable by their kilts. The kilt was only abandoned as frontline dress relatively late in the war, when it was realized that when poison gas was released, Scottish soldiers suffered disproportionately because the gas got under their kilts and inflicted terrible burns. But for most of the war, the Scottish Highland regiments wore the kilt, and the Germans called them devils in skirts, or the women from hell, because they were very distinctive in the way that they dressed. They were also distinctive in the way that they fought. And it's clear that the Scottish regiments not only suffered the highest casualties of any army in the war, but also probably inflicted pretty hefty casualties on the Germans. They were renowned for the ferocity of their conduct in action. And it's clear that, for example, Scottish regiments were involved in the incidents of prisoner killing, which I detail in one of the chapters in the books. This is important because my grandfather was in one of these regiments, and I suppose I would never have written the book had it not been for the realization that as a teenager, my own grandfather had been in the Seaforth Highlanders and had been one of those young men that you see in the plates in the book, sitting in a trench waiting to go over the top and kill Germans.
Do you know if he wore a kilt when he was in battle?
Yes, he did. I still have it.
Did he? Did you talk with him about that?
I was very young when he died. I was about 4 or 5 when my grandfather died, so I don't have clear recollections of the kind of conversations that I would love to have with him now, where he's still alive. But he talked enough with my father about it for me to have a reasonably good idea of what his war was like. Unlike the famous war poets and war novelists, nothing survives of my grandfather's war on paper, just a box full of a couple of medals and a small Bible. But the memories he passed down through my father to me were enough for me to reconstruct more or less what he went through.
What's one of those memories that your father shared with you?
It seems pretty likely that my grandfather was there when the Germans launched their final all-out offensive in the spring of 1918, which very nearly won the war, because he described the experience of seeing the advancing German infantry and preparing to be sent into action against them, and feeling absolutely certain that this was it, because the Germans at this point seemed quite unstoppable. And at the very last minute, a neighboring unit was sent over instead of his unit, and he was pretty sure that that decision had saved his life. And that's one of the kind of stories that is etched on my memory from my days as a small boy.
How do you think World War I affected your family's feelings about war?
I think it had a a very profound effect on Scotland because of this very high mortality rate. My own school was dedicated as a war memorial after the war was over, and so I went to school every day passing the war memorial, which had these, in these huge letters, "Say not that the brave die." And I always used to think to myself, well, hang on, they did die, brave or not brave. And I certainly, as a schoolboy, was strongly attracted to the anti-war message of poets like Wilfred Owen, whom I was encouraged to read by my teachers. And I think my own family certainly were liberals with a pretty strong pacifist streak. There was certainly no appetite for another war or any more war in my family. And when my other grandfather had to go and fight in the Second World War, he ended up fighting the Japanese in Asia, it was with no great enthusiasm and a deep sense of resignation. And I think for me, coming to terms with this family memory is part of the reason for writing the book, not least because I began to realize that the anti-war literature wasn't really the whole truth. In some ways, it's a rather unrepresentative take on the frontline experience. I mean, you mentioned Ernst Jünger, but Ernst Jünger is not an anti-war writer. When you read Jünger's account of being on the Western Front, it's constantly referring to the exhilaration of military experience, of the front experience. And for people like Jünger, or more notoriously for soldiers like the young Adolf Hitler, the First World War wasn't just a hellish experience, that at the same time that it was hellish, it was also a supreme test of their manhood, of their inner strength, and the friendships and comradeship of the front was something which lived on in their imaginations after the war. And that was one of the surprises I suppose I had when I started to do the research for the book.
My guest is Neil Ferguson. His new book about World War I is called The Pity of War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Neil Ferguson. His new book is called The Pity of War, Explaining World War I. Now, in your book, and this is probably the most controversial theory that you offer in the book, you say that you think the war was the greatest error in modern history and that England was heavily to blame. You think England shouldn't have gotten fully involved in the First World War. Why not?
Well, I think it was very likely that a European war was going to break out in 1914. For reasons I try to detail in the book, the Germans were deeply worried about Russian armaments, felt that they were losing their position of strategic advantage, and that if they didn't do something pretty soon, they were going to slip into the second division of great power status. So a war on the European continent in 1914 was highly likely, and in some ways the surprising thing was simply that it hadn't broken out before. The question that was still open, as late as the 2nd of August 1914, was whether Great Britain, and I'd rather call it that than England, whether Great Britain, with its enormous international empire, would also become involved in such a war. And what I try to argue in the book is, A, that there was no binding obligation to become involved, despite what politicians subsequently claimed, and B, that it would have been in Britain's best interest to have stayed out. In other words, to have let the Germans win a continental war against France and Russia. So I'm really making an argument about the British national interest. Of course, one implication of that is that America probably would have stayed out too. But that means the war never really becomes a world war because it's British intervention which turns the European war into a world war, and it is also British intervention which ensures that the war lasts as long as it does. The tragedy, in a sense, of British intervention is that it is enough to prevent the Germans from winning the war, but it is not enough to win the war decisively for Britain, France, and Russia. And ultimately, the United States has to come in to finish the job off 4.25 years later, after the death toll has risen as high as we've said already, towards 10 million. And this surely was the greatest error of 20th century history when you consider all that followed from this ghastly slaughter.
Do you think that if Great Britain had not entered the war, that Germany would have won, but the war would have been contained?
Well, Germany would certainly have won a war against France and Russia, plus Serbia and Belgium. There's no question that without British reinforcements and without British financial support, sooner or later, the French resistance on the Western Front would have crumbled. And I think the only question is when. I don't think it would have crumbled by Christmas 1914, as some of the more optimistic Germans hoped, because we know that the Schlieffen Plan, the plan the Germans used, which envisaged encircling Paris in a very swift victory, was unrealistic. But I think by certainly the beginning of 1916, if not earlier, French casualties would have been so huge that they really would have been unable to continue and would ultimately have been unable to sustain their defence of northern France. Now, what does that imply? Well, it certainly implies a more limited war. If Britain is not involved, the war doesn't have the potential to escalate at sea in the way that it does once Britain intervenes. It almost certainly means there will be no war in Africa. It almost certainly means there will be no war in the Middle East, no invasion or attempted invasion of Turkey. So for all those reasons, I think it would have been a war much more like the War of 1870 when Germany went to war with France. It would have been like a combination of that war with a war against Russia of the sort which nearly broke out in the late 1870s, a much more limited war, fundamentally a European war, and one which would probably have been over by the spring of 1916.
World War I was started in part when the Archduke of Austria-Hungary was assassinated by a Serbian nationalist. Talk a little bit more about Serbia's role in the early days of World War I.
Well, the First World War has changed many, many things in the world, but Serbia is not one of them. 1912 to 14, Serbia is making trouble in the Balkans. 1989 to 99, Serbia is making trouble in the Balkans, and in much the same way. I mean, you only have to go back to the First Balkan War of 1912 to read accounts of Serb soldiers charging through Kosovo, committing atrocities, burning down villages, raping the women, mutilating the men. So at least in one corner of Europe, it's a case of plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Now, of course, the First World War could have just been the Third Balkan War. I mean, the option was there when the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand happened for there to be a limited conflict with Austria taking reprisals for this act of terrorism, which clearly had been to some extent state-sponsored, or at least sponsored indirectly by Serb intelligence. The problem really was that from a very early stage, both Germany and Russia were determined that this should be the basis for a wider European war. It should, in fact, be the pretext. And so the Serbs, rather unwittingly, in pursuit of their own objectives in the Balkans, namely the creation of some even bigger Serb state, unwittingly trigger a massive European war, which ends up being totally calamitous for the Serbs themselves. But this isn't their plan, nor is it, I suspect, their plan at the moment.
How was Serbia changed by the outcome of World War One?
Well, in a way, the Serbs, despite losing huge numbers of men, their mortality rate is second only to the Scottish regiments, end up in territorial terms as big winners. Yugoslavia was one of the creations of the post-First World War peace settlement, although it wasn't initially called that. It was the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats and Slovenes, I think, and they renamed it Yugoslavia in 1929, I think, to save on ink. And this was essentially the moment when a quasi-federal South Slav state is created with the Serbs as the dominant partner. And it's been a pretty unstable edifice ever since. It plunges into bloodshed and into Nekine feuding in the Second World War, and it does it again after the Cold War. But if you ask, you know, where does Yugoslavia originate, the answer is it originates in 1919, when everybody is trying to figure out in Paris what to do after the war and how to reward the people who had rather unwittingly started it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Neil Ferguson, and he's written a new book called The Pity of War, Explaining World War I. You wonder in your book if the gains of World War One justify the loss of life, the massive loss of life. And I wonder, like in your mind, how do you do that calculus to decide how many lives are worth losing in war? I think that's just the most impossible calculus to do. Well, so what are your thoughts on how to calculate?
Well, nowadays, of course, certainly the American view and possibly also the European view is that zero lives should be lost, at least by your own side, in a war. And, of course, this is the direct opposite of the view for the first half of the 20th century, when in two world wars, the European states were willing to sacrifice millions, I suppose a grand total of going on 30 million lives, for the sake of what? And you have to ask yourself, here we have the death toll, and one of the things I try and do in my book is to set out as accurately as possible the death toll, the figures country by country, as a percentage of the male population, as a percentage of the men who were actually sent into battle. You have that death toll, and then you say, well, okay, what is achieved here? And you can list the achievements. For example, the neutrality of Belgium is restored, and Belgium and northern France are freed of German troops. And German troops are also moved out of those parts of Eastern Europe which they occupied in the course of the war. And then you say, well, what other achievements are there? Well, the British Empire acquired a few more colonies from the Germans, and the French acquired some too. And then you say, well, what other things were achieved? Well, the Austro-Hungarian and the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire temporarily, these great empires were split up into small nation states with more or less degrees of success. Now, are these achievements, and these seem to be the principal achievements, really worth the sacrifice of 10 million men? It seems to me, when you consider how short-lived the peace that was achieved in 1919 was, I mean, it's 20 years of peace is what's achieved, before the whole thing is subject to revision again, before the Germans throw the whole settlement overboard with the outbreak of the Second World War. You know, 20 years of peace for 10 million lives seems to me like a bum deal.
Well, Neil Ferguson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Neil Ferguson teaches history at Oxford. His new book about World War One is called The Pity of War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Fresh Air is also available online at audible.com/freshair. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Scholastic, publisher of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, the magical sequel to Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our Memorial Day show with an interview from our archives with photojournalists Horst Foss and Tim Page. They covered the Vietnam War, in which they were both wounded. Their 1997 book, Requiem, is a memorial to the photojournalists who died while covering wars in Southeast Asia.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On Memorial Day, we commemorate those who died in war. Today, we have an interview from our archives about photojournalists who died or disappeared while covering war. In 1997, I spoke with Tim Page and Horst Voss, two photojournalists who were wounded in Vietnam but survived. They edited the 1997 book Requiem, which is a memorial to the 135 journalists who lost their lives or disappeared while covering the wars in Indochina, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The book collects some of the extraordinary pictures these journalists gave their lives for. Tim Page is an English freelance photographer who first started taking pictures of war in Southeast Asia at the age of 18. He was wounded four times while covering the war in Vietnam. He's worked for wire services and magazines. Horst Voss is a German photographer and editor with the Associated Press. He was the AP's chief photographer in Southeast Asia from 1962 to 74. He's won two Pulitzer Prizes. He's now AP's senior editor in London. Page and Voss knew many of the photographers represented in the book Requiem. I asked what impact it had on them when a colleague was killed while taking pictures. Page answered first.
I think probably in Vietnam we became a little inured in a certain sense, and he went on and surfed over the trauma of it, the emotion of it, because should you let that trauma, emotion, dominate your existence, then it'd be damnly difficult to go back out in the field and make more pictures. You didn't make light of it. You became very, very sad and very reminisced about the person, but had to make light of it, or else you could not go out and function again.
Horst Voss, did you find that when you had a friend or a colleague who was killed in Vietnam, a photojournalist who was killed, would it make you any more or less cautious in your own work?
I was trying to be cautious from day one. I had covered other wars before, and I knew it was dangerous. As an agency reporter and head of the photo operation of an agency as AP, and these days the death of somebody always for a very brief while stopped all the activity. I mean, people talked to each other, and I talked immediately about this person, and nothing much happened in the AP bureau, but this time was really very short, and then everybody tried to get back to work almost more determinedly than before. For the photo editor himself, who was possibly the one who sent the killed colleague out on the assignment, there was a lot to do. The body had to be brought home, the family had to be informed and talked to. We attended funerals in the beginning, and we tried to bury the mourning somehow under activity. Do you understand?
No. Wasn't that sometimes your responsibility? Weren't you often the assigning editor who had to take care of that?
It was my responsibility to deal with headquarters, explain to headquarters what had happened, and then talk to the family, talk to the wives, or talk to parents, and explain what happened, and go out myself to the place where a person was killed and see for myself what happened. I remember going out and trying to find one of our American photographers, Ollie Noon, who had been shot down in a helicopter. And took 3-4 days of walking with troops that were under continuous attack until we reached the helicopter. Well, I found the camera, which had been thrown clear, and the film inside was still intact, but there was almost nothing left of Ollie Noon. So I watched the people that deal with corpses and remains, watched them sorting out the scene. I kept the camera and went back to Saigon and had the difficult task to explain what happened to the parents and the sisters.
What did you say? Do you remember?
No, I think that was very, very private. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we tried to be honest at the time. We tried to be we tried not to use the normal words of mourning and I'm very sorry and so on. He was the greatest. No, we didn't do it. We tried to We try to be very clinically exact what happened, how a person died, possibly saying that there was not much pain, there was just sudden death, and try to be honest. Huh?
Were you ever in a position where you had assigned a photographer to go someplace to take pictures and they were killed on that particular job?
Well, no assignment was an assignment where people were ordered to go to places. We generally assessed the day-to-day situation, and then photographers would go out according to their preferences. So we had Vietnamese who would rather go out with Vietnamese troops. We had other Vietnamese photographers who loved the American Marines. If they did so, then let them go up there.
Did you ever try to talk an AP photographer out of going to a certain place?
Oh, yes, many times. I mean, I myself spent about 50% of my working life in Vietnam in the field. That means I would go out 4 or 5 days and then stay in Saigon 4 or 5 days and play the editor for the others, and then go out myself again and leave another photographer in at the editing desk. We took turns, so we all had our experiences there. I, being a little bit on the senior side already in these days, I was 30 and older, so older than many of the young colleagues, including my friend Paige. I tried to warn people. I tried to instill to them that they shouldn't go with bad troops. They should rather pull back and take care of themselves and look out for photos when situations became dicey, and never ever be foolishly risking chances.
What are bad troops?
Bad troops are the troops that don't take care of themselves. Marines that don't dig in. Patrols that don't put out points. Companies that go through the jungle in single file without having flanks out, troops that handle their weapons sloppishly, artillery observers that don't check out the terrain properly, and so on.
Did you find that when you traveled with troops, that they looked after you, or did they see you as a burden, you know, someone who's not a member of the military who's tagging along?
That was one of the main features of a good combat correspondent, combat photographer, not to be a burden to the troops. It started with being equipped and dressed like soldiers. It means you had to have the right boots, and you have to have your own overnight gear, and you have to carry your own food. The only thing you don't carry is your weapon. You had to protect yourself with a steel helmet and a flak jacket, just like they did. And when there was danger, you could not count on them putting a shield around you and defending you. No? You had to just run with them and hope for the best. But it was not our role to participate in the fighting. On the other side, among the communist photographers, that was their prime role. They were soldiers foremost, and reporters, propagandists, or photographers secondary.
When you were photographing combat, what kind of rules of thumb would you use to know when to take pictures and when to just run for cover?
I think it's a cross purpose. You learn where you can. It's a sixth or seventh nature. You learn where you can take pictures from and be safe simultaneously. You learn how to move, where to position yourself. You learn how to shoot on the run. And this is without the advantage of today's all thinking and singing camera and autofocus. You learn to anticipate, you learn to try to sort of preempt what's going to go on and where you can place yourself. It becomes a sixth or seventh sense in the end. You just automatically know where, you know that a rubber tree won't stop a bullet, so you don't hide behind a rubber tree. Admittedly, the opposition can't see you behind the rubber tree, but stray weaponry will come through that rubber tree.
My guests are photojournalists Tim Page and Horst Voss. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with photojournalists Horst Voss and Tim Page. I spoke with them in 1997 after the publication of their book Requiem. David Halberstam wrote a piece in Vanity Fair in which he talked about you, Horst Voss, and he described you as one of the first photographers in Vietnam to use a Leica, which enabled the photographer to look forward instead of down. Would you describe what that difference was and how that affected your safety and your photographs?
Well, I wasn't the first one to use Leicas. Larry Boas arrived there almost at the same time, had considerably more Leicas than I had, because at the time AP was still working with large format cameras, and I carried one or two of my own Leicas in there. Well, a Leica camera is a camera where you can keep both eyes open. You can look with the free eye that doesn't look through the viewfinder in all directions, except backwards, and sometimes also backwards. And you can look through the viewfinder and see your picture. So may it be sports photography or may it be war photography, the Leica camera at the time appeared to me a camera that made it possible that you were at all times aware of things happening around you.
Tim Page, did you use that too?
Initially, nay. But after I had made my first spread and had my first spread in Life magazine in mid-65, almost the first thing I did with all this newfound wealth was buy two Leicas in Hong Kong. But it has to be said that almost the first foreign, one of the first foreign photojournalists to be killed in Indochina, Robert Capa, I mean, of World War II fame and Spanish Civil War fame, also used Leicas. I mean, they have been the camera of choice for war photography since, I mean, they were used by the Germans in the Second World War. I mean, Signal magazine consistently had photographers using Leicas and Contaxes. I mean, a Contax looks much like the Leica, much similar technology and lenses. But it's always been the strongest. It's kind of the Rolex of the cameras.
Mm-hmm.
The Rolex cum Volkswagen.
The other wonderful thing with the Leica was that you could actually take it apart like a rifle, clean it out, dry it out, put it together again with a set of little screwdrivers, and it would work again. Something that is impossible with today's electronic chip cameras.
Drying it out when you're in the middle of the jungle was probably a good good thing to do.
No, it happened very often that you fell into a water hole or in a river and
bomb craters.
You couldn't operate anymore. Your whole being there was useless. And at that time, if the troops would take a little break, you'd take your cameras apart and put it on a black piece of plastic and hope the sun comes out and dries your cameras out. If not, they go back in a plastic bag and you wait for the next stop and then spread them out again. So sometimes it took a day or two or three to get the stuff working again, and then you were back in operation.
Well, I can imagine how you must have felt, though, when your camera wasn't operating and you're caught in combat and wondering, or at least I'd be wondering, what am I doing here?
That's right, yeah.
You spent most of your time saying that anyway.
I could, of course, become a word reporter. That goes for nights. When you're out in a military situation, you can't take pictures at night with flashlights. So at night, and in bad weather and in dark weather, the cameras went back into the fish tackling box, which was waterproof, and I would just use my mind and try to keep quotes there and write down little stories. And many a times I came back without photos, but with a good memory of a good tale. And I would sit down at the typewriter and write my story for the AP.
Horst Voss, earlier we were talking about your responsibility as an editor at the AP of dealing with a photojournalist's death, calling the family, dealing with the remains of the body. I'm wondering, when a reporter who worked with you at the AP died, what it was like for you to develop their last rolls of film, if you were able to find film on their bodies or in their cameras after their death?
Well, that's very, very difficult to say. I mean, of course, you hope that there is something on this camera that would be worthwhile to be sent out and be a last testimony to a man's a talent that wrote a very important chapter in the history of photojournalism in this century. When a man died, we looked back at his work and we we tried to assess what he had achieved and what he had done in his lifetime. The last roll of film was simply like the last paragraph of a story. Of course it's sad, and of course it's everybody comes and looks at it and tries to understand what happened. There's a picture of a young Indian who traveled via Singapore. He desperately wanted to be a reporter, photographer with the AP. He lived only 14 days. When he was on his last military mission, he was up front at the point of a company and on a patrol, and a mine blasted into the company. He didn't have the experience to know that one mine seldom comes alone, so he stood up and photographed American medics helping dying soldiers. While he took his last six, seven, eight pictures, a second mine exploded and cut him down, standing up at the time and taking these pictures. So I remember very well his last roll. There were 18 negatives. And the last picture shows clearly that he stood and that he took a picture that he went out there to take, combat, that is. The picture almost explained his death. These last 18 negatives, I remember, were sent on orders from headquarters to the then general manager president of the AP. It was a very detailed explanation how Charlie Chalapa died. Our president wanted to know how it happened again that an AP man died. What could we do better to prevent the repetition of this? Well, there was no answer to my report because nothing was done wrong except that the man shouldn't have stood up after a first mine. So here, the last pictures were telling the tale, and as it happens, they are about the only pictures that are remembered of Charlie Chalapa, one of which is published, his last picture indeed, and published in our book, together with my slightly apologetic message to President Wes Gallagher, why Charlie Chalapa died.
My guests, Horst Voss and Tim Page, are photojournalists who covered the war in Vietnam. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with photojournalists Horst Voss and Tim Page. They were both wounded while covering the war in Vietnam. Their 1997 book, Requiem, collects photos taken by colleagues who did not survive the war. Horst Voss, you were wounded in Vietnam. What was your wound and what impact did that have on your life, your work, your commitment to war photojournalism?
Well, I was wounded in December 1967 by a big rocket fragment that tore through my legs. And thanks to an American medic who somehow pulled me back, and thanks to a tank driver who moved forward and loaded me and brought me back to some clearing, and thanks to a helicopter pilot who came in and picked me up together with some other wounded, and thanks to surgeons who decided not to cut off my leg as I intended to do first. I was aware that I was on the way to recovery 4 or 5 days later. And the only decision I made at that time was not to go to Honolulu or New York or anywhere, but to stay in Vietnam. One reason being that I had total trust in military surgeons who were dealing with these problems day in, day out. And secondly, I tried to avoid having my legs broken again at the New York head office and being made a photo editor at headquarters, because that would have ended the great days of photography. Yeah? Being in Vietnam and being around a major story of the time was always a great shot of adrenaline, and put it frankly, we enjoyed ourselves much of the time.
Well, Tim Page, I believe that you were injured and returned to combat more times than any other photojournalist in Vietnam.
I was hit 4 times, in 1 train wreck and 1 motorcycle wreck and 1 car wreck. After 3 woundings, 2 of them relatively minor, I mean, in combat or out in the field. The third time was fairly serious when an American Coast Guard cutter shot up by American planes, about 400 pieces of shrapnel in my body. At that point, Time Life paid for me to leave the country, and I was given a contract to work out of the Paris office and cover the 60 war and other conflicts in the West. But I had to go back in 68 during the Tet Offensive, just after the Tet Offensive. I couldn't stand there and watch the Tet Offensive go on, as it were, live on television and seeing the pictures in Life magazine and all my buddies and friends' pictures being used, and I'm sitting in Los Angeles, thumb up my bum and mind in neutral. And I took a one-way ticket back to Vietnam, arriving just in time for the second Tet Offensive, when the press corps lost about 8 people in 3 days. And instantly I arrived with 50 cents in my pocket, and within 4 days I had 6 pages in Life magazine. It was something was bigger than we were. I mean, speaking from the freelance point of view, it was the war to be in. And providing you went out enough and got towards where it was hitting the fan, then you could guarantee getting decent spreads into magazines and sell your images, be it to AP or UPI or to one of the other agencies, or you would have a commission for an assignment to one of the major magazines, and that's what you're being paid for, or you were trying to break into that world so you became a known photographer.
You were wounded several times, 4 or 5 times in Vietnam, kept going back for more. Did you ever feel like you were tempting fate, that you'd come so close that you should just stay away?
Yeah, in 67, it got to that point when Sean Flynn, Errol Flynn's son, and myself were sitting in a bunker just inside the demilitarized zone, the DMZ, on the south side. And we'd gone in with some South Vietnamese airborne forces to retrieve bodies and wounded from when they'd been ambushed the night before. And we were caught by North Vietnamese artillery. And then immediately after that, by friendly fire, American phantom bombers came in and strafed and bombed us. And Sean and I ended up in a little tiny house, a shelter underneath the house, cowering and just terrified. And we both made a pact that we were going to get out of there very, very soon. And I got out within about 6 weeks of that event, and Sean left within a couple of months of that event.
But Sean ended up dying in Vietnam.
He was captured. The whole of this book and the memorial process, remembrance process, started back in 1989, when I went to Cambodia to unearth or to try to discover the fate of what had happened to to Dana Stone and Sean Flynn, 2 photographers. Sean was working at the time for Time, and Dana was working for CBS. And they were captured by North Vietnamese come Viet Cong reconnaissance troops, very close to the South Vietnamese border, but in Cambodia, and were given, after that, at that point, to Khmer Rouge about 4 or 5 months later, and were held for something just over a year, and were finally executed. And a French student who was doing his research on journalism in Southeast Asia managed through the Freedom of Information Act to get details about their demise, these declassified documents in the CIA and DIA, and had sent me copies of these things. And I tried to get as close to the site as possible where they had been executed and held. And at that point, I decided I was going to try to build a memorial to all the media had been killed or wounded or missing in Indochina from all sides, not just, should we say, from the West, but from the Vietnamese side, North Vietnamese, Viet Cong side, Liberation Front.
Tim, what was the last wound that you got in Vietnam, and why did you stay?
I didn't stay. I mean, on the last wound, I took a piece of shrapnel in my brain, and they took out of my brain 200, about the size of an orange, 200 cubic centimeters of brain, which left me paralyzed, hemiplegic on the left side for over a year. When I was brought out of the field by helicopter and on the way to the next medical post, I was declared dead, and they had to jumpstart my heart a couple of times. And the hemorrhage at the point when they started to open my head up, as I said, got to the size of a large orange. And I was dead at that time, so I'm told. I mean, I can't actually recall much about that, to be quite honest.
How good has your recovery been?
It's a bit of a limp. I don't know if you ever really recover from something like that. You always, you recover physically. I mean, I've been back to Vietnam 27 times. I was there this year for 3 or 4 weeks. But my agility has always been impaired since. Mentally, I suppose it gives you the strength to go on and do other things, maybe something like this project. I mean, one can only say that, you know, with the grace of God go I. I mean, one is alive, and you can't sit and somehow weep and gnash and wail about that dilemma in the past. It's over.
Tim Page and Horst Voss edited the book Requiem, a collection of pictures by photojournalists who died or disappeared in the wars in Southeast Asia. Our interview was recorded in 1997 when the book was published. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our Memorial Day edition was produced by Kathy Wolf with Alan Tu. Bob Purdick is our engineer. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Little Brown and Company, publishers of Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, Stories by David Foster Wallace, available in hardcover and as a Time Warner audiobook. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Korda, executive editor of Simon & Schuster, remembers his early years in publishing, editing Harold Robbins and Jacqueline Suzanne. And Kurt Anderson discusses his new novel, Turn of the Century, a social satire about life in the year 2000. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.